black folks can dislike white folks, be prejudiced against white folks. Asian Americans can be prejudiced against Hispanic folks. That's part of our human nature, I think, kind of the brokenness, to not like persons or things different from ourselves, and we make categories, and oftentimes they're categories that are based on insufficient information, and they're not true, but we hold those prejudices within ourselves. Now, when we talk about racism in the United States today, we're talking about any attitude, action, or institutional practice which subordinates people because of their color. And we would say that a simple definition is institutional power plus prejudice equals racism. And we make that distinction because we firmly believe that in the United States today, only white persons have the institutional power to reinforce their prejudice. Our systems and institutions of our culture and our society, whether they be the legal system, whether they be the educational system, whether they be business and industry, banking, real estate, whatever, are basically white institutions that where the standards are defined and set by whites, and oftentimes then that institutional power is used to reinforce our prejudice, and we call that racism. Is that kind of straight for everybody? So that, because sometimes when people talk about racism and prejudice, they interchange those words. And we prefer not to do that. We like to keep them separate because it's really our understanding that in the United States today, only white folks can be prejudiced, or rather racist, because we hold the institutional power. As a white male, and sexism is another part of that, that could be another workshop. As a white male, I can go places and do things and exercise all kinds of power and authority within systems that just isn't available to the majority of persons of color in our culture.
And you can choose, and it's not always your choice.
Right, yeah, and I benefit from that, from the structures, from the institutional benefits of white racism. I benefit from that even if I don't want to. You know, I might say I don't want to oppress people in that way. And part of the work we do is to talk about making a commitment toward being an anti-racist, so that you just, it's not enough to say, well, I'm not racist, because not doing anything about that then ends up just reinforcing or allowing the institutions that exist to kind of carry on and therefore continue that oppression of the system, of the institutions against white folks. So those are our two definitions. Question?
If we can cut out some of our prejudices, will that help racism?
Well, it'll help personal relationships often.
Absorbing some of
the benefits. Working on our prejudices will change some personal relationships. And that happened a lot in the 60s and the Civil Rights Movement, where people worked with each other. Part of the reason folks got burned out with the issue of racism and civil rights in our country, I believe, is because we didn't make a lot of institutional change. And there were some laws passed, the Voting Rights Act and some other things, indeed fair housing laws, that sort of thing. But in some of our basic institutions, like education or the criminal justice system and else, we didn't make any institutional changes. And so even though I became consensitized and aware and worked on some issues myself, and you know, I stopped calling black people niggers and all of that kind of stuff, okay, I overcame some of my personal prejudice, unless I make a commitment and work proactively to make changes within institutions, then the racism doesn't go away. Okay, is that?
But you can't get into dealing with racism unless you understand your own prejudice.
Yes.
And that's the catch-22, because if we could talk, you can't work on changing the institutions without having some kind of understanding of why that, how that happens and how you've been trained to be benefit from a white system. And that's where it all comes together. I know. The other day on our first workshop, we wove a tapestry of statements about our faith statements. And it really is, for me, an understanding that what we do, what Chuck and I are doing, is really a matter of faith and a matter of a long journey, that we're part of a whole system of people who are working against oppression. And one of the things I talked about was sin. And today, instead of doing a review of my whole talk, which usually ends up being the whole talk again, I'm going to read a piece written by Will Campbell from a little book called Race and the Renewal of the Church. Now, the problem, I'm going to say this before you all look at your paper, the problem with this book was that Will was really moving on racism in the 1960s and wrote this book, but he hadn't been aware of the sin of sexism. But since then, I can attest to the fact that he has grown, and he doesn't write like this any longer. But so please forgive him or honor his growth in sexism, and I will try to change his language as I go along. But this was a book written many years ago, but it still talks about what is the sin. And for us, that's getting at why is racism a sin? And what is the sin? To force fellow citizens, because of the color of their skins or any other reason, to live in ghettos which breed hostility, bitterness, and crime is wrong. But this is symptomatic. To refuse to employ people on the basis of race can hardly be justified by any Christian standard. But this is not the real threat to Christian doctrine. To threaten, taunt, and jeer mothers who take their children to the schools to which they have been assigned by law is to demonstrate less than Christian love. And yet, the segregationists can debate you to a standoff if you make this your starting point. These are all humanitarian and egalitarian concerns that certainly lie within the province of Christian witness, but which, taken alone, are not enough. The segregationist who is honest and who wants to remain loyal to the church has very clearly seen this point and has taken clever advantage of its weakness. There is, however, something that neither the segregationist nor the integrationist have seen. In a real sense, human beings are not the subject, the point of reference for their own well-being and happiness upon the earth. Neither the racist nor the person upon whom that person casts indignity, the disinherited, Negro or white, the builder of houses or the rejected from houses, the employer or the one deprived of employment, the passer of legislation or the victim of repressive legislation, the murderer or the murdered, none of these is the true referent, the true subject. The only point of reference is God. The sin, therefore, is that the whole issue of race is an effort to deny the sovereignty of God, to negate the absolute supremacy of God. Once a person has truly seen this truth, that person can no longer be a racist, nor can that person any longer grovel in the agonies of self-pity. From that point on, the racist logic and desire for self-justification terrify him. As for the racist, that one is now afraid to call any person unclean, to discriminate against any person, to stand in judgment over any group or individual, or to set that person himself above any of God's creatures. From the moment either the segregationist or the integrationist really accepts the absolute sovereignty of God, that person is forever thereafter terrified to usurp that authority or claim any part of it for himself. And that is precisely what one does when we determine our patterns of behavior by classifications of race and class, or think that God is obliged to conform reality to our notion of what ought to be. You're on. That's my review.
The other day we had some of those statements of faith up here, and wanted to share this as a way of talking about oppression, not just the oppression of racism, though I do want to mark that up here on the board. And Sue, would you hand out those?
Oh yes, the purple one.
I've got a thing like this for you so you can take notes on it. We won't have to have anything separate. And I'll put racism up here. as one of the...
I even have markers if somebody wants to.
As one of the isms that we often talk about and identify as oppression in our society and in our culture. I mentioned another one earlier was sexism. And I guess a couple more that I've heard the last few days here at Holden, for example. I think what the workshop next door is about and what some of the other material Dan Erlander has done certainly talks about nationalism or militarism, if you will, as isms which oppress our nationalistic, militaristic posture in the world is the cause for oppression. So we could put down nationalism or A-R-I-S-M. I'm not a very good speller. And the other day, after we did our first workshop on what color is your rainbow, someone shared with us that they didn't think that perhaps the problem in our country wasn't racism, but that it was classism. Again, another issue that divides us one from another, but also puts us into oppressive postures one against another, is the issue of classism. And those are just four, and in a moment I'll ask you to help me identify some others, maybe that we've talked about here in the village in the last week or so, but also perhaps ones that you experience in your own life. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit about the shape of our outline here, the cross. The cross is a symbol of liberation for us as Christian folks. But the scandal of the cross is that it's also a symbol of pain. And in a real sense, the journey toward the cross is a very painful journey. It was a painful journey for Jesus as he made that journey. And it's a painful one for anyone who has chosen to carry the cross that leads toward liberation. So I would say that the journey toward the cross is a journey of pain, while the journey away from the cross is one of liberation. Because in his action, Jesus liberated each one of us and all creation from the ultimate terror and tyranny of death. In a real sense, and that's why it's neat to be Lutherans, I think, and I don't mean to offend anyone in the group who's not Lutheran, but I think being a liturgical church and having the drama and the panorama of moving from Palm Sunday through Passion, through the Holy Week, and to Good Friday, to the Passion, and then, as so many of us crazily do, you know, having those 5:05 or or 4:59 sunrise services, that we understand, we act out in our liturgy that process of a painful journey toward the cross, and the liberating journey from it. And that's important. And it's really significant, I think. There are many churches who celebrate Palm Sunday and who celebrate Easter. And Holy Week is, in their traditions, kind of a, you know, well, Good Friday. It's, you know, who wants to talk about that? Well, we need to talk about that because it's a significant event, the turning event in salvation history for each one of us. And so we like to use the shape of the cross to help us remember the pain that takes place in the journey. There's a theologian, Mary Daly, who for me is very helpful with the way she uses language. And one of my favorite words from Mary Daly is re-membering. And tomorrow afternoon we'll do a little exercise on remembering. But when Mary Daly uses that, she means to make ourselves whole again. To re, that is to take the members, the parts, the pieces, and put them together in a whole way. And we believe that in terms of oppression, the isms in our world, particularly in our focus on racism, that we need to remember, we need to both recognize and understand ourselves as oppressors and what racism means in the life of others, and that's painful. But that's part of the process of being liberated, is the necessity to go through that, our own Good Friday, if you will, in terms of our part in the world as oppressors. Because if we don't, if we just want to say, well, let's forget all about that. Let's just
everybody love everybody.
Yeah, just everybody love everybody. It's kind of like, if we all overcome our individual prejudices, we'll be fine. But unless we do some examination, some painful examination of ourselves and of our society and our culture to reorder, if you will, I shouldn't get too carried away with those hyphens.
It's not renewed.
But I would really suggest that we need to do the painful part of the journey to being liberated, to being committed to an anti-racist stance in the world, to be committed to an anti-sexist or anti-militarist or anti-classist stance in the world. We need to first look at ourselves and the systems that we benefit from and participate in a very hard way that's often painful, because it may mean recognizing something about myself or the way I've acted or the benefits I've obtained perhaps unknowingly or in a way that I haven't wanted to obtain benefits, but it's significant, I think, that we do that we take part in that journey toward the cross so that we can experience and understand the liberation that's been promised to us. The other day, I think it's up here in the weaving. Let's see. Well, I can't find it here, but Sue talked about Luke 4:16. In terms of, it's the justice one, justice for all. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because I've been called to proclaim release to the captive, sight to the blind, feed the hungry, proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. That liberation has already been taking place for us, and we know what our job description is, if you will, what we as Christian folk have been called to do. And sometimes, oftentimes, these isms, our role in oppressive systems, get in the way of us being able to carry out our job description in the world. And we need to examine that, take light of it in terms of our own personal experience, and then make some commitments to change and be proactive. I guess at this point, I'd like to see if we can identify some other forms of oppression, some other isms that exist.
I would like to suggest through that each one of us experiences being an oppressor in some parts of our lives. One of these isms is one way we've got, but we also, each person here could talk about the place in our lives where we're the victim of an ism, where because of society has said the power, the people, somewhere, I'm not going to say power people, but there's a place where we are victims, like sexism, where women have experienced being treated as less than human beings, as less than the people around them, because of the rules are set up in a way that say that we're less than. So I would suggest that as we think about that, think about places where you might be oppressed, and you know how you would describe that, or how, or some of the things you've heard here, or how you might participate in that.
Did you have?
Where would you put communism in this system, since our government, even our church, has sort of taken the communism as the enemy? Does this fit into this picture at all? Is communism a concern to us here?
Well, I think it could be considered under nationalism. I would like to suggest that we examine our nation and what we see as our brokenness, and not point to other places, you know, other nations or other countries, and say, well, there's their problem, communism, which may deny the reality of God and oppress people who want to be faithful Christian folk. And I don't have any problem with that. If we were doing this in a global sense, I'd like to suggest that we try and see that, though.
But it is a form of nationalism. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's what we're talking about, where when a country assumes that it has the right, as a government of a country assumes that it has the right to oppress the people in that country or in other countries. And, you know, you talk about our relationship, like maybe to Central America, may be nationalism as much as communism's relationship to Afghanistan or the people, the Jews in that country.
Is so that saying that we try to dictate to them the type of government they should have and not give them the choice to decide if they want communism or some other forms? So you got to have our form of government to be acceptable.
To say that there's only one group of people
that we're right, that everybody else is
wrong. That we claim sovereignty of God. You know, that we know what's best for everyone is to claim sovereignty of God. And that's the isms. Yeah, so that's a good example.
Does anyone have any others?
What about age?
Oh, well.
People, either because they're kids and they're under the age of 18 or 21, or
because they're 62 and retiring, so they're no longer an identity.
Yeah, because they're old. You know, if you are between about 21 and, say, 55,
it's becoming changing now. I mean, we were told we could get a pass to the park system, you know, we're 65.
it will eventually. Right, sure. But I think ageism is a reality in our culture. In terms of economics, in terms of business.
If you're in the low end of the high end.
That's right. And you know, if you could be a very successful career person, or me, my father-in-law worked for a trucking firm, and when he was
54.
When he was 54 years old, he got to work one Thursday and they handed out pink slips everywhere and said, we're closing tomorrow, we sold the company, we got, you know, a better offer, and the company's going out of business.
Worked there 34 years.
He had, the only place he'd ever worked for his whole life, and he was never really able to get another job that paid more than $5 or $6 an hour. He ended up working most of his time as a security guard, second shift. You know,
breakdown.
Yeah, really had a, and simply because, you know, no one wanted to hire someone who was 54 and had only 6 or 8 quote unquote productive years left. You know, that's a reality.
And that's ageism.
Well, along the same line, I imagine. Aren't we as parents oppressing our children at certain ages?
I think you're right. Yeah. I think we assume that
we have authority,
a power,
over them,
a sovereignty.
I never talked about parentalism. But
no. That's part of ageism. Sure. It's part of the divisions of.
Okay.
But you know, you talk to parents who feel that they have a right to beat their children. Because they're children, their possessions.
Yeah, until they're 18, then they can go anyplace.
Right.
You know,
and
you hear that.
They do. Yeah. any other?
It's always a hope.
Any other forms of oppression that we've talked about here at Holden, or that you've experienced in the world or in your own life?
Well, again, paternalism is not quite. I don't think quite the same as parentism, but know, companies that take care of their employees. They want to keep them, they want them not to go and spread word that maybe they're doing something wrong, so they give them a little bonus here or...
Sure.
Or when we treat someone, we give them little pieces, that paternalism, we give people little pieces to keep them in bondage.
That's really how most of these forms of oppression work. Okay, instead of increasing your Social Security, we'll say, well, if you come to our national parks and you're over 65, you won't have to pay $2 or $4.
Or $10.
$10. Okay. So isn't that wonderful of us, you know? Where on the other end of that, the majority, you know, many, many older Americans who aren't able to drive places and go to national parks and take that benefit, you know, may be living at survival levels or even under those levels in terms of economically because of the structure of our Social Security system. So that paternalism often works in all of these forms of oppression to kind of, you know, keep the crowd quiet, you know, kind of salve over some of those gaping wounds and say, well, it's, well, but look at what we did for it. So I think that's a good thing. Any others?
I have two more, but I'm waiting.
Okay. I would say in some ways capitalism.
Well, capitalism as a... This isn't intentional, I'm just trying to balance it here. ITAL, yes.
Don't ask me.
You know, and maybe that's an accurate, just in terms of economic systems, ways of structuring ourselves where we say, you know, this is the only right way, this is the way...
But there is a sense of that.
I think to argue communism, capitalism, communalism, socialism, you know, as saying, well, this is the way God ordained the world to be, I don't know that that's true. I could not, you know, zero in on any one of those particular forms of how we organize ourselves corporately as a society or as people. And saying, well, this is the way God ordained things. There may be some guides to how large systems like that ought to treat people in terms of justice and equity and that sort of thing. But certainly not labeling this, that, or the other form of government or economic structure and say this is the way it works. Any others?
Well, yeah.
I don't have an ism for it, but I guess it would be the oppression of anyone with a disability.
Yeah, that was one of the ones I was calling it, handicapism, for lack of our budget. Disabilityism?
Maybe the ism is, but if you are okayism for it.
Okayism.
Yeah. Well, I...
Or holism.
Well, yeah, I had thought of holism this night in the sense of you're not whole unless you are. I mean, that's really our vision.
And
our
whole
society.
Means...
You know, four limbs and two eyes and perfect ears and the perfection. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Perfectionism.
And one of the things we need to think about as we're doing this is how does that affect the person who's oppressed? You know, and as you said that, I think of, I had polio as a kid. And being up here, going up and down the hills, I'm taking a lot of stress just to do it. But I'm feeling guilty because I can't be whole like the rest of the people, you know? And that makes, there's a real sense of being less than. And that can get played out in lots of different ways if people aren't careful. So that you feel that you're not quite a whole person. We can talk about how we feel that people aren't quite whole, but there's also then that what happens to those who are oppressed, and that's part of what we're talking about racism. Bye.
So I've just really been over the last few years that the holding has been wheelchair accessible.
Precisely, you know,
maybe the last 2 years.
We serve an urban parish and it's 80 years old, and you know, it's in the city, but it's still, you know, the foundation was built up 7 feet above the ground, you know, and there's 20, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. It's just a nightmare.
We can't
any person
to get anyone
who's less than fully able.
Yeah.
You know, not, you know, whether it be a walker, a cane, a wheelchair,
or limited lung capacity to get up the step. We have a ramp,
a lift,
a lift. No, we don't even have ramps. There, it's just impossible.
Part of the problem being the building, except on the one level, was built in so many stages, like in the basement. There's three, a kitchen and a couple fellowship halls, and you gotta go up and down.
And the bathrooms, the stalls are this wide, you know.
You couldn't even get in there with a walker.
It's bad as a tube, you're heavy.
Well, it doesn't look like Miss America, it's not, it's rather, it's, you can't go and buy clothes if you aren't.
That's right.
Any other forms of oppression?
What about state churches, such as you see in some of European countries, in which other churches are not, do not have some of the same access?
Let's call it churchism, because I don't have a word for it, but it's the kind of saying that the power of...
We don't have that in the United States.
Yeah, we don't have it in a sense.
State government.
We don't have a state-run church. But we do have some sense that if you are a Buddhist or
a Muslim,
a Muslim
in our cities,
that's the U.S. expression.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, but what we're trying to that's what we had kept saying. We'll try to stay in the U.S. focus and that.
Okay, but that sort of, you know, that there are some mainstream acceptable parameters in which our understanding of religion ought to fit. And if you're outside of that, Eastern religion or...
Sure, outside of the newer sects.
Right.
Right.
Or you up and in this country, you can talk to your Jewish brothers and sisters and ask them if they've experienced oppression in this society. And I would imagine they would tell you what some of their experiences are. What is anti-Semitism?
Yes, sectism.
Sectism,
or
that might not be such a bad idea, because think of the people who were not ministered to because they didn't fit into your certain categories, you know.
Right.
I'd like to.
I've got one more.
You got one more.
I have one more, and it comes from a lot of discussion that's happening here this week. And it's not an ism. It's homophobia, the oppression of people who are gay or lesbian. And that's real. I bet there are more.
I bet there are. And it's sometimes painful both to recall when we've been a victim of oppression. And it gets harder, not to say that it doesn't happen, but so many isms are kind of white male, Western based in the sense of that. And it's hard for me as a white male to say that I can in a depth way understand the oppression that many people, women, persons of color, poor folks, you know, as it becoming economically secure, as all the kinds of things that we react against or try to insulate ourselves, if you will, from the world, whether it be economic wealth or education, all of that kind of stuff. It's difficult for me as a white male to say I can understand that. I can hear from my sisters and brothers their stories, and that helps me, it educates me, and it reminds me, but I can't just say, and part of the problem for me then is that sometimes I can't even understand or see very clearly where it is I'm oppressing others, because I don't know any clues to look for. That I say, I know that causes oppression because I've experienced it myself, you know. It really is hard work and often not real successful because of my experience and who I am. And I don't feel, you know, I can't feel badly about my creativeness. I don't feel guilty about who I am as a creative person because I'm exactly the person God created me as, I'm sure of that. But I am called then to examine and work on some of that stuff in a faithful response to that.
One word that keeps going through my mind is just apathy.
And I suppose that's what you do, is you get people to think about these things. But, you know, a lot of people just don't even care or don't want to try to find out why people are oppressed in different ways.
That's absolutely right. And apathy is really a form of the current popular rape-isms.
I almost said, and I thought, well, I don't know if it fits in or not. Apathy
is a way of saying, going with the way things are. And the way things are is racist.
Yeah.
The way things are is sexist. The way things are, so that being apathetic is really in support of and acting in line with the isms that it is easier to be those things than to work against those things.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't affect me, so I don't even care or want to know anything about it type thing.
I thought you'd like to hear.
One of the things I'd like to do now, I'd like us to perhaps continue our discussion at probing both our own oppression and perhaps begin talking a little bit about what kinds of ways can we identify to work against these oppressions. It doesn't necessarily even today have to be racism, because in the next sessions that we'll be doing, we'll be really focusing very directly on that. But as we do that, I'd like to pass around some scissors. And if you'd like to, in case you haven't figured it out yet, your little thing there.
I was giving a little demonstration.
Your little note thing there can be trimmed up and reformed into the shape of a cube. And as I do this one, I'll continue talking and explain why we do that. We believe that you need to have this cube or some other kind of model. Maybe there's something with, how many isms did we go? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six there, 12. What's a 12-sided figure? You know, maybe it needs to be a 12-sided figure. Or maybe it needs to be a 16-sided figure. You need to have some sort of model when you're talking about oppression that keeps them all in dynamic tension with one another. Because we believe that one of the things that happens too often in our country is that we become the people of the most recent or most popular ism, and we don't understand how they're all oppressive agents that are interrelated to one another, so that we might say, oh, racism, gee, we did that back in the 60s. What are you people doing way back there, you know?
We get that
for many years, particularly, and I want to say this clearly so that I don't offend anyone who's listening, but particularly in the late 60s and then into the 70s, the anti-nuclear movement, for example, our friends in the peace movement, which at that time especially was predominantly white, a white middle class movement, okay, would say, no, don't talk to me about racism or classism or sexism, because it was predominantly a white male middle-class movement in terms of the leadership of the peace movement in this country. They would say, don't talk to, you know, if we don't solve this problem of the potential for, you know, nuclear warfare, you know, we won't have those other problems to worry about. Kind of a very thin and narrow vision. And then as we came into the 80s, and those movements became more consensitized, then they'd say, well, why aren't there any people of color here? Or why don't we have any women as leaders in Africa? And if you would go and listen to those people, if you would go and listen to Native Americans, for example, they might say, well, if you want to talk to us about the economic oppression that comes about on our reservation because uranium is mined there and we don't get the full benefits under our trust status with the United States government, that there's some mining company that's making some money there, or if you want to talk to us about the health problems that occur because of our native men working in the mines, gee, then we'd be interested in your issue. Or perhaps in the city, if you'd like to talk about, for persons of color, particularly black folks, about what it means to not be able to have a job, because in our country we spend so much on building bombs that economic opportunities, because I don't have the figures with me, but if I recall correctly from back at that time, you know, whatever it costs to build one Trident submarine employs, you know, creates jobs for, I don't know, 1,000 people, and if you spent that much money on teachers or people providing human services, you know, you could employ 10 times as many people, you know, because those are labor, people-intensive industries, whereas the military-industrial complex is really not a labor, it's a technological-intensive kind of industry. Big dollars spent on expensive things rather than on people. And so we use and promote this particular model here so that you can understand that you really, you know, in our lives you may have to say, well, I only have energy to spend on, you know, actively working in and combating X issue, you know, whatever that may be. I don't deny that, because, you know, there's only 24 hours in a day, and a person has only so much energy in their life.
And besides, we're on the 500 to 1,000 year plan.
That's right. For those of you who weren't the other day, the 500 to 1,000 year plan is a plan that we try and operate off of, which means we try and discern, if you will, within our life and our community, how it is we fit into God's plan for the salvation of creation and the coming of the kingdom, rather than putting together our plan and sharing it with God so that she'll know what it is ought to be happening. And so we'd like to suggest that folks, you use this cube to remind yourself that oppression, by any name, is oppression.
And it's a wall.
Right, and that to deny that reality of that, or the pain of that, simply because it doesn't happen to be an issue that you or I have time for at the minute, is really another kind of, I mean, maybe there is an issueism, you know? I mean, sometimes our churches get into that, and we become victims of it, right? And then if
the
we want to,
the year, the
you know, and if we want to stay with an issue for a long time, people get bored, or they get burned out, you know, or they become distracted because they just don't want to, you know, they want to say, well, teach me something new, you know, tell me about the next one coming down the line. Don't just keep talking about that same old stuff all the time. And that's really too bad, because we really like to feel that, as Christian folk,
we're all struggling.
We're called to combat these issues in faithful ways, as powerfully and as strongly as we can. Now, let me see, if I hold this together, we should end up with a cube, which can help us see that these forms of oppression are interlinked with one another, and that from time to time you may turn the cube and see or notice another form of oppression. And the other thing it might help you do, I hope, fits together eventually. The other thing it might help you do is to understand that for some folks, if you're poor and old and female and black. There's lots of different oppression working in your life. And you can't just say to someone, well, if we just took care of this chunk of this person's life, the community we live and work in, which has many single parents, many elderly, many persons of color, cannot be healed, cannot be made whole again with just one simple application of a magic panacea in one area or another. Because all of these forms of oppression are interlinked, interconnected, and depending on if you are the victim of one or two or three or four or five, it creates so many layers in your life, so many layers of oppression. I've got some glue sticks here if anybody's interested.
They're not real good on this paper, but you can work on it. Or you can take it apart and put it in your folder.
Right.
Get it back.
Glue it up when you get home.
One of the things, there are a lot of things here that we hope that doing this, physically looking and feeling that, is a way of understanding that what happens to people who are oppressed is that you become boxed in. And sometimes our answers, and this is why, back to your original question about prejudices, sometimes our answers in themselves our answers are, well, you can pick yourself up by your bootstraps. You know, sometimes our answers to people who are feeling oppression is to try to lift one person over the wall, you know, or pull them out of the box of that kind of, pull the top off of their oppression and pull them out and keep rescuing them one by one through the, and pulling them out of the oppression without ever realizing that if you just tore down that wall, then there wouldn't we wouldn't have to keep trying to help individual. And that's some of the stuff we're talking about with institutional oppression. For me, it would be a good time for you to just kind of think about this and raise issues and questions with us. We've done a lot of thinking, and we can do little bits and spats of our thoughts here, but it would be nice to hear what do you think about, what have you heard today that's kind of, you'd want to spend a little more time on thinking about, or what's happening with what you're thinking when we talk about oppression and being oppressed or being the oppressor.
I guess a thought, and I'm not sure, Sue, if this is where you want to go yet with these discussions, but one of the things that bothers me, I guess, about these things is that, you know, you have to consider yourself a racist. I am a racist, okay? And if I look at the definitions of racism, okay, I can accept that. But I don't feel racist. I don't feel sexist. I don't feel nationalist. The thing that I'm struggling with is these things seem to be not from me, but from institutions which I have only some very small part to play in them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess the thing that's bothering me is how does one get beyond their personal feelings of, well, I'm okay, I'm not doing that stuff, to dealing with what you're suggesting that are real issues, and that's institutionalized isms, institutionalized oppression in our society. How do we get beyond our saying that we're really okay ourselves individually, we're not bad people.
That's right.
And deal with institutionalized oppression, which, as you say, is in our society all around.
Well, for me, the answer to that always comes in community, and it needs to be as often as possible as inclusive a community that is including all the different varieties of victims of these forms of oppression to A, because sometimes it just may be a reality, whether it be because of a political reality, because of a reality of our own energy and time or our resources or whatever, that we need to discern some priorities of you know, what are we going to work at in our lives or at this time within our community, whether it be our church community or whatever. And the best way I find to do that is to be in dialogue and in community with as many people who encounter oppression as possible, so that they can help me decide. Because one of the things that happens is we could just all sit around as white folks and say, well, we understand that that as white folks we are oppressors because of our society that we live in and that sort of thing, and here's what we're going to do for those folks, that we need that input.
That's right. I guess that's one of the things that I'm getting at, is that it's easy for us to sit here and say, well, those are bad things, and we should really oppose those. But it's another thing then to go out of Holden back into
right.
the real world. And
that's right.
Then what are you going to do about those things? How does one in a middle-class, American, predominantly white community deal with some of these deep, oppressive attitudes, which we don't think that we're participating in anyway, overtly. I don't know if you want to go that far yet.
Maybe. Well, I think what it is it's kind of an onion here that we're dealing with, because we can just keep peeling. We have to look at lots of different layers. And it stinks too with the grill.
Like that onion makes you cry.
And it makes you cry. An onion, you write that down. Somebody asked me the other day, how do you come up with ideas? There it is. But what you're doing is you're saying, wow, you know, how do I get at? And there are all kinds of things that work and all kinds of things that don't work. There is some answers that seem flip that aren't. One of those answers is you can't do it alone. You will end up burning out and being angry, frustrated, and ineffective. To try to be an anti-racist all by yourself, or an anti-sexist. For you to walk around saying, I'm a feminist, doesn't change anything until you sit down with your sisters and say, what are we going to do? And that takes time. You can't talk about homophobia as if no one, and decide what you're going to do for those poor people. You got to sit down and say, what is it that you're feeling? And how do we undo it? And that's the 500 to 1,000 year plan. It really, that's why we say that, because there aren't a whole lot of answers that totally work. There's some faith weaving that works. That's a bottom line, some grounded questions. That's what that weaving is. It's some grounded questions. Does this deny the sovereignty of God? If you're playing God and deciding somebody is superior or inferior, then that denies the sovereignty. Is this seeking justice? Who's the oppressed here? That's a tough question. White males can be oppressed, you know? They can be, and sometimes by participating in the system, they box themselves in and oppress themselves. You know, and I'm saying that kind of because that's the one where you end up the whole white male that's not a home, not a gay person, that's not handicapped, that has a job that pays him to put him in a certain class. I mean, that person all of a sudden doesn't end up represented on this cube, but because of all kinds of things happening around him, he becomes ineffective and oppressed by the system that says he has to maintain being the person that's not touched by all of this stuff, and to allow yourself to be touched. How do you go about doing that? Well, we're going to talk about layers, and we're going to talk about how overts and coverts and unintentional racism and how to get at that. We're going to talk about how it works in institutions and getting at that. Can you leave Holden and do it? Not by yourself. Not by yourself. You get in the box and you cut off. I see all that. You get in the box and what you end up doing is cutting little air holes. And if you manage to cut little air holes in the box, hopefully there's other people poking little air holes in the box and there'll be so many air holes it'll fall apart. But that's really what it's about.
Well, I think one of the problems too in feeling that you have some say or feeling that you have, you know, some access to doing something to help is that a lot of us aren't even ever exposed to any isms. So you're not confronted with this on a day-to-day basis. At least I live on a small island where I don't think there are any black students in my children's school system, so we never have to think about it. Probably 95% of people are either Protestant or Catholic. I'm not sure there's any Jewish, you know.
So they're all, at least Christian is the...
We as a family don't personally know anyone that has a different sexual preference. You know, you might know a few handicapped people, but, you know, how often are we really, as average citizens, unless you live in a large urban area, really, really touched by the situation? I think
couple things.
Exposure is a problem.
It's harder for you. Somebody asked me if I'd like to serve in the suburban parish, you know, mm-hmm. talking about the possibilities. And I said, I think that would be harder for me in that trying to do the things I do and be the person I am than it is in an inner city where I'm working with such a variety of people that I'm constantly reminded, constantly bombarded, constantly being challenged to think. So it's difficult. But there are some answers.
I'd like to suggest some resources. Your description made me think of this book. It's entitled Liberating Our White Ghetto. Because we do indeed tend to ghettoize ourselves, insulate ourselves, in a sense, from isms, from the pain and oppression in our world. And
remember that book was written, what's the date in there?
Again, some of these in terms of language, remember, they're really good guys.
Joel's coming up here, he'll be up here in 2 weeks, one of the teaching staff. So.
For Whites Only, another book. That really help in terms of analysis and suggest some directions for action, but particularly for us as white folk, help us understand and hear our problem. Because one of the dangers is that sometimes we want people of color, you know, to solve our problem. So in the church, for example, we'll have multicultural commissions or whatever. And we'll put all the black, Native American, Hispanic, Asian folks there and then say, well, now tell us about racism. Well, we're the experts.
That assumes that the victims are, you know, what the victims are the ones that have to undo the red wall.
Two other tools to help us grow in kind of a whole vision of the world would be a Wild Lord, some psalms and sermons and prayers from Namibia to hear what the gospel sounds like through the words of a person who understands oppression. In Accord, another piece that has litanies and prayers and songs in it from a variety of cultures to help us celebrate what we understand we're seeking for. I mean, it's okay to extend our grasp beyond our reach in terms of the way we celebrate and who we are. That helps us grow. Those are all available over in the bookstore. There's some definitions there on racism, and also a piece that's called Working for Life, Dismantling Racism, which is a handbook for talking if you were working with other groups and wanted to do some things. A tool to work through with other people some exercises and things to kind of promote growth, understanding, and action.
Okay. One of the things I would suggest.
We need to end here.
Oh, okay. We're ending, so if you want to leave, leave. And then I'll tell you what I would suggest. One of the things I would suggest is that remembering that white folks have a culture. Now, what we do is not culture-free. How we, what we eat, how we dress, how we hold our children. I learned that because our Korean son came and I tried to comfort him, and I finally had to learn that the only way to comfort him was to put his back to my chest and tap his chest, and then he was comforted. But culturally, my thing is to hold a child to me, chest to chest. Well, that's not comforting. So that's a cultural thing. But we have many, 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 many things in all areas of our lives that are dominated by our white middle class or upper middle class culture. And what we tend to do is say, we don't have any culture. They all do. My favorite example of this that's come this week as we were talking, because I'm very aware, off and on, very aware that I have a great, wonderful Southside Milwaukee Midwestern accent. And I spent many long time in seminary trying to pretend I didn't have that and worked really hard on pronouncing. Well, the point is that's who I am, but I don't ever hear that. I hear all of your accents. But I never hear my own. So I don't have an accent, you all. And that's kind of what we do with culture. We say, they all have culture, I don't. So if they all spoke like I did, then we would be culture free. That's not true. We would all be white, middle class, and have that thing. And so the thing that you need to do is identify what about you, how are you culturally bound? And how are you cutting out other cultures? And maybe opening doors for experiencing some other things. So not the final solution, but a solution.
So that when we invite others to be with us, we're not saying, come, you need to be like me. But rather, come, let us be different together.
And that's tough.
And that, you know, but that I think is the weaving, the wholeness of creation. It's who we are called to be as God's people.
Thank you all. Thank you. We're available for coffee. Carry on.